Sveiki, mėly Radio Vilnius klausytojai Vilniuje ir du radio klausytojai Paryžiuje. Su jumis sveikinasi laida Puota ir mados žurnalistė Deimantė Bulbenkaitė.
Bei šiuolaikinio meno kuratorius Audrius Pocius. And once again, we will turn to English for the last time this evening and this week. Welcome to everyone who's listening in Vilnius through Radio Vilnius and to everyone who's listening in Paris through Du Radio. And this is the last installment of our series of interviews that we're doing as a show Puota, in English, The Feast. And the host of this program are Audrius Pocius, contemporary art creator, and me, Deimantė Bulbenkaitė. Kaita, fashion journalist. And for our last interview, we've picked a very special person. Actually, it was quite an intrigue because we didn't know whether we will get the chance to talk to you, but we are extremely happy that you're here with us in the studio. And I'm very proud to present the researcher, curator, scholar, writer, and I probably could add so many more, Mėta Marija Valiušaitytė. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Labas. And as per our tradition, in our show Puota, we always ask our guests to bring one piece of music that means something to them or just kind of fits the context. So could you tell us what you picked for today and why?
So the piece we are gonna listen is a piece by Erik Satie that was played, that happened in Paris in 1917 and called a scandale between public and those who were performing. None of the sides understood what was really happening and what the other was expected. So, yes.
Okay, let's listen. So, Mėta Marija, thank you so much for selecting this piece by Satie. But could you tell us a bit more, first of all, the name of the piece and what was the scandal behind it?
Well, Parade was performed in Paris during the First World War, 1917. And on this piece, Jean Cocteau had invited to collaborate the most avant-garde people from all the sides. So Pablo Picasso did the costumes, Leonid Messina did choreography, Satie wrote the music, and it was one of the pieces of Ballet Russe. Well, problem, the public did not at all understand it, but the artists were delighted.
It's so interesting to listen to you, like explaining, you know, like and picking this piece of music in particular, because I don't know another person that would actually be such knowledgeable about this context, because you are a Picasso scholar, Picasso expert, and I just wanted to ask you, how did it come to this? How did it come to this? You know, how did this interest in Picasso, you know, grow from an interest, you know, to a professional occupation?
That's quite a large question that I have asked probably myself too many times. How did it come? Well, Picasso for me is a prism to think about other things. So it's definitely not the person, not his biography. He's widely known for his life, and that's the least thing that I'm interested in. What he did with his hands is fascinating. This incredible curiosity and the making of things is why I continue working on Picasso. How it came? Well, as a scholar, you read widely about subjects, and then there are things or names that you come upon and that raise curiosity. And it happened that there were things about Picasso and moments in his works that I did not understand. And so then I kept on digging. And the more I read, the more questions I had. And so it never stopped. Maybe to be noticed that Picasso, who is born in the end of 19th century, so the first Picasso is 19th century artist as well. He started as a symbolist almost, mm-hmm. and then he embraces the whole 20th century and continues to be of importance for the 21st one. So embracing three centuries is...
You mentioned that you see Picasso as a prism, and this is also something that I'm interested to hear more about from you, because, you know, Picasso oftentimes is regarded in a modern paradigm. Like sometimes, like you can also hear, you know, art historians even distancing themselves, like from Picasso, just like in terms of the discourse, you know, like that he also represents, like this kind of masculinist, like avant-garde vision of contemporary art that, you know, like people really want to leave behind sometimes. And at the same time, Picasso is a prism of change, you know, like of, you know, changing of the conception of art, you know, like throughout 20th century. And how do you see like this change, specifically like in the reception and the notion of art and throughout Picasso's career, but also it's his relationship to contemporary art and today?
Oh, that's quite a wide question. I'll try to pick parts of it. What I meant with the prism is that asking different questions, and then like I'm interested in faces and bodies, and looking through this question in what Picasso did, I have quite a lot of fascinating material. Like body was body more than portrait in the 19th century sense of really portraying a person and having somebody seated. So less the portrait than the body was his interest, and he continued touching it the whole career. So, and another question I'm interested in are ruins, modern ruins. So I can come later to that. The other part of the question was,
you know, because I understood this idea of prism as related to like the change in conception of art in general throughout his career. And I was thinking how well, or maybe like it's not relevant at all, but maybe this prism could also like work as a certain prism to look at art even today.
You mean?
I just mean, you know, The change, like in Picasso, like how I see this, is a very general question, is that he is associated with several changes, like paradigmatic shifts, like in expression. And I was wondering, like, if these changes, serve for you, like, to interpret art in general, you know, like your relationship to art today. Or maybe not at all, I don't know.
Of course, probably you mean by changes the stylistic changes, mm-hmm. And that's helpful in art history, and that's also problematic thinking in terms that are well known and that people even think they know the beginning of and then the end and then the next one coming. I see the whole picture much more fluid. Sometimes there are no ends, and you see moments that reappear decades later, and that is fascinating. The phenomena probably many people connect to him as cubism, which for art historians a lot often have beginning and an end, 1907 to 1914, which can be discussed. I would see it as a much more source that is always there and that appears, disappears, and reappears again and again.
I know that you work with several institutions that are dedicated to Picasso's huge body of work. Some of them are in France, some of them are in Spain. And it's very interesting to know that Picasso spent most of his creative years, especially here in Paris, but he also was from Spain. So is there any difference when you work with, for example, when you work in Malaga and when you work in Paris with these institutions? Considering the heritage of the artist, the legacy.
Probably there is always a difference when you work with different people, teams, or different tasks and subjects of your exhibition shows. So it's always an experience, and mostly, it is always each time fascinating. There are 5 Picasso museums in the world. Indeed, I happen to collaborate with 2 of them. There is the Picasso Museum in Paris. Then there are 2 Picasso museums in Spain, in Malaga, in the city where he was born, and in Barcelona. And then there is a Picasso Museum in Antibes, in the south of France, and this is a fascinating story. It's where the artist once spent a summer, and because he had a very dark studio and was very unhappy, his befriended museum's director said, "Hey, I have a huge room in my museum. Would you want to use it as a studio during the summer?" So he did. And when he left, he graciously left a body of works, and then he also had painted the walls out of it. So that's what happens when you give your place to artists. Mm. And there is a last one in Germany, in Münster. So I did a little parenthèse. So working with different institutions, it's each time different and fascinating, yes.
But when you create exhibitions of Picasso's work in the 21st century, how do you translate his works and his ideas to the audiences of today? What ideas do you feel that you can highlight that the audience will really connect to?
Well, I wonder if the word translating is the right one. It's rather, I think, communicating or like inviting for an opportunity to really look deeply into things and objects. I dislike the word artwork. I prefer calling them works or objects. And when you physically and having time and the willingness look at things, and this is not only fascinating for Picasso, it's when you look at things, you definitely discover, and this is for every artist. Mm. So this is normally, it is an invitation. And of course, for me, an exhibition is a storytelling. You communicate or communicating something that previously has been found. What I or curatorial team believes is worth communicating and fascinating. So we kind of, we share our fascination and hope that the people jump in.
I wanted to ask you about like a project that is perhaps very current to you and something that you're working on now. And it is an exhibition by Emilia Scornolita that you are curating. And, you know, like the way you talk about works and objects, you know, like what did you find fascinating about Emilia Scornolita's work that made you want to work with this body of works?
Oh, so yes, we're jumping from one subject to another, and this is a very different relation working on male artists who died 50 years ago. And so the first thing is working a lot with archival material and objects. And the other project is a dialogue. It's a true dialogue. It's not working on, but just facilitating and collaborating and working with. So Emilia and I have started a conversation several years ago, and we kind of went for walks. We met, we talked, and then somewhere we understood that we would like to do something together. And so, yeah, that's a completely different way of dealing with what at the end is a show. And obviously, in terms of Emilia's works, many of them are intangible. They are not objects to touch. You have to bring time. And this is something that always is for me important, that time is involved and time is very important. And yes, like scanning things, objects or films is not a good idea, even if people think they get the idea. You need time.
With Emilia being a Lithuanian artist, of course, she's a very globally well-known artist right now. And we see her traveling all the time and we see her exploring different cultures, but she's still a Lithuanian and you're a Lithuanian. It's not that I want to make like an obvious connection, but is it a bit different to talk to a person who comes from the same century, who kind of maybe has the same cultural background, maybe lives in the same time?
Maybe yes, and maybe not necessarily. There are things that we connect very well, like gardens of our grandmothers who were very, both we believe, similar. They both were called Aldonas. So that's that's something that connects us. And we both have a huge passion for plants and vegetable gardens. So yes, maybe being both kids who were... Yeah, who were born in the 80s and were touched by same political events. So that's one story. But on a more serious manner, I think it's a dialogue about things that are not necessarily or at all connected to borders nor origins. Our conversation started in Florence, and then the invitation I made to Emilia was coming to France. It was well before the Lithuanian cultural seasons in France. There is a place in the south in France, which is called Villefranche-sur-Mer. It is a 16th century military fortress, and it is surrounded by the Mediterranean Sea from the three sides. And Emilia Scornolita is an artist, I'm putting it in a very simple way, who thinks through waters. Mm-hmm. So when I discovered the place many years ago, I saw the place, and for me it was quite clear that this is a place for not any other artist, but for her. And so this was another point where we started another kind of the discussion.
But could you tell us a bit more about the project you're working on? I know that it's still quite a secret, maybe, because it's still not open, but could you give us any hints about what you're working on or what your discussions are about during the process, during the preparation for the opening?
I might tell just a couple of points that could be interesting. Otherwise, I happily invite everybody to come to the opening of the show. The show is called Tétis, as the polar ocean. It will open in November 15. And we have been thinking through the years about depth, the depth of the sea and the depth of the sky, which means the place where the show will take place. It is, as I said, a military fortress. So the place, it's a really, they are not underground, but they are kind of cave-like spaces. And Emilia is installing works, or she makes the whole place in a work. She invests it all. So it will be a huge installation. And she is working on a new body of works.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited where this all leads. It's very soon. And yeah, so death is a key word.
Okay.
And yeah.
Well, I'm excited as well because, you know, I know Emilia's work quite well. And throughout the years, because she's so well known, like, and so well articulated, it, I think, became harder and harder for her to have freedom, you know, like, of interpretation. You know, like, sometimes people take her work for granted, you know, like, too often. And I'm really excited to see, like, what happens, like, in this show, because, like, it sounds like you put a lot of thought and imagination, you know, like, into this work.
I think she did. And I think the important moment is that the time moment we had, I don't want to say we had a lot of time because there is never enough time, but we tried to take it slowly. So before now the exhibition will finally take place, Emilia had accepted our invitation and she came several times for over a month to the south of France. So having her fly and really settling there and being physically for over a month was exciting. We had time for walks and for swims, and mm-hmm. she had time to, I don't want to say settle down at all, but that was very fascinating and probably an experience for everybody. And what is important for this project is that we happily had a chance to work with wonderful scholars from different disciplines. Accidentally, to add about the interest of the place, which is very French, my own approach is always in situ. I start from where we are, and this invitation kind of communicated this message. So there is this fortress, accidentally in a form of a star. And next to it, there is the Oceanographic Laboratory of the French Sorbonne and National Research Center, where accidentally over 100 international scientists since over 100 years sit there and think about the depth of the sea. So the place worked, and we just jumped in, and people very generously answered, just jumping in as well into the discussion. So it has been over 2 years of pure joy and exchanges and curiosities. And now we have to get the work done. But the ride was wonderful. And to add more, next to the oceanographic laboratory, there is also an observatory with which we collaborate. So we also look to the sky. And here I stop.
We can see that you are a researcher and a scholar. And just right now you talked about researchers and scholars in south of France and how they contributed to the process of this show that is going to open in November. But maybe you could tell us a bit more how being a researcher and a scholar has shaped your own curatorial practice.
Ha. I probably don't see it that connected. It is probably all about being continuously curious and always asking questions. And there are always questions to ask. And life is beautiful when you have questions, so because you can always learn and you can enter into discussion. People will become very generous when you are. So this is about talking to people directly, obviously, as a in your own work. Well, I spend most of my time not talking to people, but rather reading and writing. So it's a lot of being alone with your ideas, but you are not alone because you are surrounded by ideas of other people. So there is no scholarship that is born in tabula rasa, I don't believe. Mm-hmm. It's something else. And I think it's very sad when people do not give attention to what has been done before. I see it as a discussion, and that's wonderful.
I also wanted to come back a little bit to the project with Emilija Škarnulytė, because I was wondering, like, maybe there would be like a publication following that exhibition, and if there would be, whether like all of these contexts that you just like mentioned would, because like it's not actually feasible or even preferable to, you know, like do this like in-depth like exploration like of all of these like things like in the exhibition itself. But, you know, like if there's a publication, maybe like they would be articulated or touched upon there.
There will. We hope so. We are working toward that. And you're right. I think that what we exhibition makers and what artists do, it's a lot of work. What an artist puts into a project, it's like sometimes it's several months, but sometimes it's several years. And it shows an ephemeral practice. It's wonderful for those who accidentally see it. But when it is over, if there is no material thing left, then, and if the show did explore new ideas, because of course there are shows that bring beautiful things together and it's fine, and in the moment it is very special. But for exploring ideas, publications are important. So we try to take it seriously from there, and we're trying to put together something that we very much hope will and be interested. It's a small book.
Another topic that seems to be very interesting about it is when me and Audrius, when we started to do like our little research before the interview, one of the first things we noticed is how international your career is. There are all of these cities that pop up when you start to read about you. It's Berlin, it's Florence, then you have some other cities in Germany, you have France, of course, you have Lithuania, you have Spain. Could you tell us a bit more about what does this international background, international career mean to you? What does it mean to your career? Maybe it's something that you cannot avoid in your line of work.
And even, you know, like more cheesy, because you basically, after you graduated from your high school in Kaunas, you know, you left Lithuania and basically, from that time, you lived everywhere. And, you know, how did it shape you as a person, being everywhere?
Well, everywhere, it's a big word. So you can be in one place at one time. So this is what I try to do. It definitely did shape me, but time shapes people. So 20 years have passed since I finished high school. So things happen wherever you are. There are clearly a couple of countries that have been of most importance, and those are, well, Lithuania, where I originally come from and where I very often still am and work sometimes, and then France and Germany, and well, Little Italy and the United States. I have been educated in France and in Germany, and it happened accidentally, not really. I started in Germany. I went to Germany when I was 18, really willing to embrace what a couple of years later ended, this very old, still German educational system, which was called or is called Magister. It's not a master. It's the Humboldtian ideal coming. It's a kind of idea of slower study. So you study a couple of subjects You have one main and two minor subjects, but they are not minor. So you actually study two or three things. And then you study not five, but rather 7 or 8 years. And so I went to Berlin. And because I was unable to decide, I mean, or I found several things very fascinating. So that's how I got into art history, political science, and literature, which in my case was Italian literature. And so, and a couple of years later, I happened to arrive to Paris in the beginning for 1 year. But in Paris, I probably was attracted by objects in the discipline of art history. It was another way of teaching. It was much more a way of physically looking at things. While Germany, I'm putting it in a very simplified way, well, Germany is more of a theoretical, and I don't want you to say that you can finish your art history studies without physically going to places. But in France, I just finished living in museums while I was involved at the École du Louvre, which is an art school in the Louvre. So we literally spent a year in Louvre, and then I never departed.
You, in one interview, I read that you, of course, said something that you already mentioned, that instead of that art history is not only about being in the library and sitting in the library, it's also about constantly looking at objects and constantly being in contact with objects. When you go to exhibitions, and I bet that you go to a lot of different exhibitions, historical ones and probably contemporary ones, what do you look for when you go to a show?
Well, I'm excited to see the objects, and the interest for the objects is a very simple one in terms that for us humans, when we are in front of objects that traveled through space and time, it's the only possibility to meet the past. When we're exposed into the object that is 500 years old, the object has physically went through moments in which we were not there. This is precious, incredibly precious, and I think fascinating. And when you give time for objects to speak, it's really about very simple looking. People just go, and then they go away. But if they stay and looked at in the object from the front and from the side, and when I teach, I encourage my students to go down onto their knees, to go into any postures that are good to look from different angles. You might see something, you might not, but you might see something. And I always encourage people to go as close as they can. Of course, not that the alarms get on, but they should test until where they go, and they go and they look. And so this physical moment is very important. And then, of course, learning, stories, explications are great and fascinating. But starting with the object is always a good thing.
So is Paris the perfect place to physically meet these objects that have traveled through space and time?
Paris is definitely a great place. There are many others too. And Paris is also well known for the collections. But fascinating collections can be found in cities way less known. So no, you actually have to... as an historian or as a curious person, should go to places. For the summer in Lithuania, I traveled a couple of days visiting tiny wooden churches that had incredibly curious objects. I visited 36 in 2 days. That was tough, but very rewarding. So you can look at objects almost everywhere.
Have you ever been disappointed by an object that you had very high hopes for?
I don't know if I tend to have. I mean, if they are real, I might be very disappointed if I go to see an object and I am exposed a copy. Then I am really disappointed.
Does that happen often?
Well, that should not happen, but it can happen if the museum has lent the thing, or much worse, if, yes, this is a kind of, I don't want to say it is a tendency, it happens sometimes. Some institutions are more concerned of never in no way doing, but like inserting copies not fakes. I mean, fake is a thing that wants to be the thing, and a copy says, I'm a copy. But sometimes the copy does not say, I'm really a copy. And if you really don't see, don't search, historical museums, sometimes they think that image does the job. Mm-hmm. And this, I think, is a very disappointing tendency. Also for archival documents, of course, objects are fragile and they should not travel that much how we wish to travel. But then I think it's okay communicating things, but not trying to reshape the form. I mean, you know, you just post a photograph, but you don't make it look old or, yes.
So you do not frame copies?
Oh, no. For example, I am very much against framing archival documents as objects. They are different things.
Fair.
You know, I was wondering, like, I will ask a stupid question, because you talked so beautifully about the possibility to encounter objects from the past. Mm-hmm. And you spoke with such sensitivity about it. And these are the words of a sensitive person, also like a scholar, also, you know, of someone who is an expert, you know, and knowing something and being able to have a relationship and even to recognize something that comes from the past is a matter of great... how do I say, technique. And for me, listening to these words is inspiring. But at the same time, I myself am a different animal. I come from Lithuanian, like very specific scene of contemporary art, which basically is based on a caesura of a kind, you know, like a certain break from the past, you know, and it's objects and actions and performances and scene building and commentary, you know, like that all happened like in flux, all from this idea of like an opened scene, you know, like about like... you know, like not having a relationship, like just like with the past. Mm-hmm. And now, like, of course, it's changing. But like this energy, like in the 90s, like when like all of our little traditions of curating that we have, like have started taking shape, have instilled like a certain language in art and a certain like political agenda into it that is actually like hard to reflect, hard to see, you know, hard to touch, you know, mm-hmm. like. And I think that there's a lot of imagination going on just of what could an object be in the future, you know, like of what does an artwork do or will achieve. And it has to do like with expectations from objects, you know, like not something that necessarily like has to do anything with the past. So I wanted to ask you, like, actually, like, quite simply, like, do you have a relationship with the scene, you know, like, or like, do you have a relationship with artworks that would be not necessarily based on what they could tell, you know, like something new, like that come from the past, but also like, do you have expectations for objects, for, you know, like something that, you know, like, do you want something from them in advance that they don't necessarily tell you themselves?
Oh, that's a tricky position to want from things or from people. I just embrace them, or I just come and look what happens and what I can learn. And I spoke about physical things as objects, but I think the same strategies of looking or strategies of attention, they do work for also for contemporary art. I mean, so obviously films projected on screens, they did not travel from time, but they need our time and full attention. And on this, I'm pretty convinced. I mean, you can think that you understand or kind of connect with the messages, but if you do not fully bring this thing, which is physical time and openness and actually the attentiveness of an eye and of a mind, then I think it's a pity because you just miss so many things. And we live in a time where attention is a very precious thing. We constantly have to choose, or somebody, something chooses for us, to whom we give attention. And mostly we just don't bring any to anything. We just are in the flow. And so here I think art, objects from the past, but also contemporary art can teach us a lesson. And this is where I think the creativity lesson or whatever else they can teach is be present. It's so interesting. It's so curious that you actually sometimes you really cannot act differently than be present because it is interesting. And this is already a great thing. I think there is much more to happen, but already this step is wonderful.
Do you think artworks themselves can have desires?
Oh, if they are active agents.
I have a question about expertise, because one of the first things that most people say about you is that you're a Picasso expert. And the word expert can contain multitudes of meanings. But I wonder, what does it mean to be an expert in a contemporary sense? Because I bet that most people probably think that being an expert means just having some sort of encyclopedic knowledge of a subject, probably. But I personally believe that being an expert means that you do not only have the knowledge, but you have the tools to interpret it in different contexts. What does it mean for you to be an expert? Or what do you think are the criteria to call someone an expert of something?
Oh, that I really don't use the word myself, so I'm pretty uncomfortable with. I much more see myself being a scholar who is interested in cultural history of the 20th century, and then if we add more of the 19th and the 21st one. And the most time I spent was looking at and thinking about Picasso, but it's also not really true because I accidentally happened in the museum and worked in the Picasso Museum. So I had the ability to look at incredible things and had to make sense of that, because when you have the material, it would be a pity not to write and not to think. And it's also, it gives me joy. And that's, again, that's time spent thinking on something. You do learn something. I would not comment more.
I was wondering, just like a simple question, the Lithuanian season, of course, you conceived the show before that, but you're still a part of it. But what, or if anything, was something that you really was waiting, looking forward to see? Was there something exciting from this program, or something unexpected that you found?
You mean the whole Lithuanian season in France? Oh, that's very exciting. To live in France and then to have all your friends coming here, it's wonderful, first thing. And then some of the friends creating new things, it's great. I think that it's a wonderful opportunity for a small country to have so much time and so much attention in this other country, which is culturally very curious. A thing to say about France is that many people in this country take time to experience culture. And this is something to learn from. This is something wonderful. Museums are always full and people go to concerts and they read books. My heart is always full. I mean, people do use telephones, of course, everywhere. But in the metro, you still see many people who read physical books, which is, I think, beautiful. And for Lithuania to have 3 months to show what they can the best is great. I mean, it's a national event. I don't know if it is, some of the artists have already showed their works before and they will continue showing, but it's a chance. People will see the shows and it's an incredible win. And if we say that there are 200 countries in the world, getting a whole season in France, it doesn't happen daily. So it's a joy.
I also want to ask you about your teaching experience, because just before the interview, we were standing here outside and you said that only recently you came back from Berlin where you taught all summer. Of course, you probably have a lot of courses that you teach and you probably work with both undergraduates and graduates. And I do bet that you probably teach them a lot about art history and you probably share your own experience as an art historian about how to approach art history and how to think about it and how to interpret it in a contemporary context. But what are the main values you try to install in your students when you're talking about art history and constantly being in front of history, in front of past, but seeing it from today's perspective?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think my main goal is that they remain curious and attentive. And whatever they shall choose after, some of them might become art historians, some of them might do other things, some of them are artists but do choose art history courses, some of them they're from very different backgrounds. I also teach summer schools, so people come also from different countries. They had very different educations. But then there is always something that does connect us. And I think it's, again, I'm coming to this subject again and again, it's looking deep, to take time to deeply look together at things. We look at things when we are outside in a museum together. This we do a lot. I try to bring them to places and to literally show how you look so that you really enjoy it. And we look at images in classroom. Images and objects is a different thing. Mm-hmm. People think that they see the thing, but it's reproductions in our books or images that are projected on the walls are different things. So I try to make them also understand that looking at images is another thing. It is a tool that we need, but it's a different thing that going and meeting objects.
Can you elaborate a little bit about, you know, like the very act on looking? Like what does looking mean to you? Like what is the texture of looking? You know, like, because, you know, you can always say like, to look attentively into objects, but the way you say it, like the way you pronounce the word, this means something else.
It has so much more layers of meaning, it sounds like it.
I think we have touched it already, but so it's a physical thing. It's about being present. It's while you look, you look. I mean, you also think, probably you describe things, but you take time for looking, because more than looking, people are screening, giving a millisecond and then looking to something else. So this is a different experience.
What was your first, because like what you're talking about is commitment, you know, like commitment,
as well,
you know,
as
and,
well.
And, it does not happen, easily. It's an experience that you have, and then like you learn how to apply it to other things. For me, at least, it was like something that happened like spontaneously, like something. I didn't learn it from anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And did you learn it like from someone, like, or was it spontaneous? Like, do you remember the first experiences for you where you committed to looking at something?
No.
No?
And spontaneous, neither. I think I just kept looking. And looking is fun. Just try to just try to really look when you are in a metro. Just for 15 minutes. I mean, you can also read. It's a great thing. But just looking at people, noticing their, I don't know, noticing the smiles. When you look to people's faces, they do also give emotions back. So we actually, in the society, we don't look anymore. I mean, of course, looking at people and objects is a different thing. But just looking is wonderful. I mean, and being aware while you do so. You notice so many details in everything. And noticing details is fun. It's wonderful because we just, again, we so much don't notice that anymore. And yes, being an art historian, it helps us, or it's the super basic of starting telling the stories, because I believe that stories are to be told that are already there. Other things are interpretations, but you just always start with a thing and see where it brings us.
As our interview is almost coming to an end, I want to do a full circle moment and come back to the piece that you selected as a musical pause in the beginning of our interview. And you selected Parade by Erik Satie. And what caught my attention, as I said, I am a fashion journalist. And of course, the history of fashion interests me a lot, and the history of costume in general, and how we think about clothes, how we use clothing as a form of expression, as something that can add a lot to any kind of artistic expression. You mentioned that when Parade was performed, Pablo Picasso did the costumes. Could you tell me a bit more about the... I cannot not ask this, since I have you in front of me and since I still have some moments. Could you tell me a bit more about the relationship between Picasso and costume design and what clothes meant for him?
Well, well, of course. I'm happy to tell more about that. Ballet Russe was a company... was Daguilev's dance company, who came to Paris as a hurricane, doing on scene things that Parisian public had not seen. So it was a crime. People were not delighted. So collaborating with Ballet Russe before the First World War was a no-go movement. And Picasso had a dealer who, I'm simplifying things to... who had a dealer who was known as a Cubist painter. Of course, nobody bought Cubism in France. It was bought in other countries through the network of his dealers. It was bought by American, Russian, and German clients. So Picasso, between the avant-garde people, Picasso was a Cubist, and so he did not collaborate with Ballet Russe. The First World War happens and things change. His dealer leaves his country. His best friends are on the front. Picasso's alone in the wartime Paris. And this curious figure, who is impresario Jean Cocteau, comes to Picasso and tries to befriend him and tries to get him involved in the affair of Ballet Russe and to make Picasso happy, knowing that he appreciates circus and harlequins. Cocteau gets a harlequin costume rented at Opéra de Paris and comes to Picasso's home as a harlequin. Picasso is, of course, delighted. He does not very quickly jump in, but somewhere he says, yes, okay. And so the same Jean Cocteau writes a libretto in which a curious thing happened. They are not necessarily very much connected. Manager figures come in and a horse, and there are many not connected scenes, and Satie writes the music and Picasso does the costumes. And while everybody knew that Picasso as an avant-garde artist is a cubist, the costumes are something else and they are very strange. And Parade is opened with a rideau de Seine, which is a stage cloth, which is completely something we could call neoclassical. And so people just don't understand the thing. And the manager figures are dressed in cubic... I have a difficulty to call it cloof, but kind of costume, they actually can't really move. And when dancers can't move in the thing, it's a problem for the public who's awaiting a rather classical thing. So again, it was a scandal.
So thank you so much, you know, like for this conversation. It was such a pleasure to listen to you. It was, first of all, I would say an experience for me to talk with you. Like, this is a conversation I wanted to have like for such a long time. It's just so happened it's on the radio.
Thank you.
And we would like to remind our listeners in both Vilnius and Paris that this was a collaboration between Radio Vilnius and Du Radio. And our interview series has now come to an end finally after 6 interviews. And today we had the pleasure of talking to Mieta Marija Valiušaitytė, an art historian, a scholar, researcher, and curator. And we're very excited for the opening of the Škarnulytė show in November. So best of luck with that. We hope that everything goes well. And we do believe that you put so much care and attention to detail into that show. And best of luck to you both, actually. And we really hope to get a publication after the show, because would be amazing to read and to experience. And thank you again for giving us an hour of your precious time. We're very, very, very much thankful to you.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine.
So, thanks to everyone. And now the Du Radio program continues into the night. And
And we're gonna DJ.
And we're gonna DJ. So, see you soon. Bye.